We are live! Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Malifaux Corners. And today we're going to talk about how to become a better Malifaux player. Today we have a special guest, Mr. Should I call you just Lysis? Lysis?
This is Alex, whatever works.
Alex? Okay. Alex here is helping me. He's actually going to take over the show a little bit. I'm going to be the one that's going against, mostly against his, I guess, opinion on certain things. But I did create the major 5 points that we want to go over. He did change the things around. So it's a 50-50. So, Alex, before we begin, can you introduce yourself a little bit? Because just in case that somebody didn't actually watch our game previously, on which hopefully the link is going to be down below somewhere.
Sure. My name's Alex. I live in St. Louis. I'm the local henchman here. I've been playing Malifaux. I started back when the first book released, like with that 40-page fact that was just monstrous. Tried to get people in then, and we actually had a decent following. Kind of rediscovered it in 2E, and it's kind of been a growing thing since there. So that's my local scene, but that hasn't stopped me from going to Adepticon, which is where I met Mario here. And
I see you're wearing some models because I'm,
huh?
I see you're wearing an Adepticon t-shirt, too.
You know, yeah, absolutely. I played a lot of great games there, had a lot of fun, and I was just like, man, this community. It even won over my 40K friends. That they were just like, well, let's check this out. And they're like, yeah, next year we're coming back from Malifaux. So I've got a good footing started here. I was really excited by the A Weird Place Malifaux League, so I jumped in. I recently had a daughter that has kind of cramped my gaming time, but I wouldn't give it up for anything.
That's a gamer in the making.
Huh?
That's a gamer in the making.
Yeah, right. Yeah, oh, don't worry. She's gonna be, whether mom likes it or not. But so the Weird Place League was a great way for me to kind of get those games in that I don't get the chance to play anymore. So yeah, that's really where I've kind of started. When Mario asked me to do the show, that I was just like, you know, how do I break down that process that just kind of happens in my head as we go? And so that's kind of, you know, how I was breaking apart these the 5 topics you asked me to go through. So really, yeah,
from my end of the spectrum, I knew Alex from Adepticon, not through face to face, because we might have clash a couple of times, you know, crossover a couple of times, but we'd never actually introduce each other. But I actually have 4 of his models, so I'm actually now a whole crew set hostage because I'm painting it for him to some deals. But he's actually the winner of the achievement, the gas lamp achievement. Is it gas lamp? No, gas quarter.
It was the Gaslight Achievement League.
Okay, Gaslight Achievement League. That requires probably close to playing Malifaux about 20 to 30 games.
Yeah, there was about 20 to 30 games. Yeah, and I was probably that crazy guy in the room.
Yeah, probably a blur for you. But so I offered my service to Sean, the organizer of Adepticon, to paint the winner's model. At first, it was only 3. We struck a deal for 4, and now we struck a deal for the whole Yanlow the crew. So it's all good. I hope I can make it before the next Adepticon, or I'll just deliver it to him personally, right?
Saves on shipping.
but let's just start. I mean, you know, we didn't meet up at Adepticon, sort of, but we ended up being friends because of the, you know, Weird Place, Fast League, and then through talking to Facebook because, you know, the whole commission business. But, yep, you know, here we are. And another reason why I chose him, because he is actually the first seated on the Vassal League. That's thanks to this dumbass that lost 10-0.
Life happens. You know, you had some clutch Black Jokers, but that's a different story for a different day.
All right, let's introduce the first 5 topics. Alex, take over.
All right, here we go. So I know it's kind of a daunting title, How to Be a Better Malifaux Player. But so this is where we're at. Kind of focusing on that setup of the game and everything that happens before you start flipping cards. mostly. So we're going to go over scouting the field. So not necessarily just deployment, but like even just that terrain setup. Now this is less of a factor on Vassal, less it's pretty much all set up for you, but that first part of, okay, here's terrain, let's define it with your opponent, because, I'm getting ahead of myself. So scouting the field, schemes, I know that was a feature in this month's, what's it called? Chronicles.
Totally a coincidence, by the way.
Right. I started jotting down my notes last week, and then I saw that, and I was like, oh, well, great. But, you know, reading it over, I think there's a lot that we can go hand in hand with. So kind of how I look at schemes when I'm considering my scheme pool. And then list building. How do we progress on those schemes and move into what goes into a good list? Resource management, kind of talking about, you know, your AP, your soul stones, your card management, and what you want to think about. And remember, this is kind of like tying into the list building, not the actual play for your resource management, but planning ahead so you can get started with at least the best chance to win. And then deployment, the actual, like, deployment phase. We'll go over that there. And then kind of the last thing there, sportsmanship and anti-douchebaggery is kind of the big thing that the Malifaux culture doesn't really have a big problem with it, so that's nice. But how can you ensure that you have a good game, it's a good, you know, friendly, gentlemanly game, and everyone has a good time?
And the reason why we added that 6 point is because the 5 points is really important. The 6 point is more like a bonus, you know, because when you go off a topic that how to become a better Malifaux player, it doesn't mean that you have to be a douchebag that wins on all costs.
Right.
Yeah, but we can go over that later towards the end.
We'll get there.
Yeah.
So, all right. Let's see. So first up, let me manage my screen real quick. Okay. So, our first topic, that first phase of defining terrain and what's it all mean. What when we're looking at it, you really have to go through that initial assessment of, okay, I'm looking at my table, how do I want to proceed? So not all boards are created equal. We've got, you have to, you'll probably already know what deployment is by the time anything gets rolling, and look for the middle line. So is it going to go corner to corner? Is it going to go straight to half? Not all table halves are created equal. Let me pull up Vassal real quick and show you exactly what I mean, because this is the Mario and I played on New Venice, and it is just an absolute definitive picture of what deployment means when it's completely different. We had standard deployment, and if you look at this, top to bottom, you can draw a few conclusions. The bottom part here, you see a lot of cover up until you hit the middle line, and then once you get to there, you just have these long open firing ranges for a range crew. So that needs to stick in your mind. If you're coming from the top, you don't have a lot of cover, and you have this severe terrain in the middle. All right, so that just keynote that for a second. All right, let's go from left to right. Let's see if Vassal will keep up. I believe in you. There we go. Okay, so now we're in the exact same scenario. On the left side, lots of cover, lots of blocking terrain. On the right side, you're just wide open. So, I mean, that's a Vassal scenario, and to a lesser extent, you'll probably see that on the tabletop itself. I mean, unless you are absolutely going, you know, mirror match for, if you're a mirror match, like, placing terrain, like, okay, top left, bottom right, bottom left, top right for forest or what have you.
Same size and everything, right?
Yeah. If you're absolutely matching, then you don't have to worry about it. But that gets kind of boring and symmetrical. So, that's what I'm talking about with that reviewing the points of interest. So we're looking for defendable points. What's hazardous even? You know, that can work in your favor or against you. You want to have that conversation with, okay, what are things that vary from game to game? Are those barrels on the field? Are they hardcover? Are they softcover? That'll make a big difference. Are there any one-way terrain features? I played a game with someone else in my bracket where there was a, for lack of a better word, wall across the middle of the field, and there was only a stairway leading up to it from one side, and it was like height 3. So we're like, wow, that's a one-way terrain feature that no matter whoever decides which way we deploy has a big pull over the game. Yeah. So really discussing that kind of stuff and figuring out, one, are you going to allow it? Are you going to alter the terrain to kind of even it out? Or are you both cool with the fact that this is just, that's the way it is? So that's something to discuss.
Now, let's say if you are in a live tournament that's not on Vassal, you have the chance to do this, to walk around, usually prior to the game starts. So I would recommend you coming in early to that tournament. But if you're playing against a friend, then, you know, terrain placement is you take turns placing the terrains.
Yeah. It'll be a very different scenario, tournament play versus your local gaming store. So that's a very good distinguishing point we should bring up. That's really just the first start you should do. You should just analyze your terrain before any other cards start flipping. This is just as important as determining your schemes. Really, in my opinion, 80% of games are won and lost based on your deployment and based on your list building. So before any cards even flip, that's one of the most...
My last game, that's when I find out that wrong deployment could cost a whole entire game.
Yes, from the very get-go. No matter how well you play the game, that starting yourself on the wrong footing, just sometimes you can't recover. So let's go ahead and move on to our second point here. We've got schemes. So let me pull up my... dude for screen sharing.
I love it when my guest is actually more prepared than I am.
That's fair. All right, so point two, schemes. What to choose and how to think them through. Now, I made this handy-dandy little chart because when I think of schemes, I think of, okay, what kind of list am I going to build to accomplish these things? You'll notice that in the Chronicles it talks some about, okay, well, think about what your opponent's going to do. And that's a good point. You should. But I prefer to take it from the direction of, well, I can't control them, so I will be reactionary somewhat to them and proactive in deciding my own scheme. So what I break this down into, you know, who is in control and what's the best unit to achieve that objective. So, and I think we can all agree that there's a schemey side of things and a killy side of things. So, the top left, assassinate, make them suffer, vendetta. These are things that the burden is on me to make them, you know, make them come to fruition. Mm-hmm. Frame for murder, murder protege, they're not always necessarily all on my opponent, but my opponent plays a big part in that. Can I keep him from hurting, you know, my bodyguard? Can I force him to kill my frame for murder target? You know, maybe if you take the right models, but that kind of weighs into your list decision there. On the scheme side of things, who's in control? Line in the sand, breakthrough, anything that just flat out places scheme markers. Awesome. That's all on me. All I have to do is make my dudes place scheme markers, and you make it happen. It's on them to remove them, but again, that's thinking too far through it. On the other hand, you have your opponents, you're giving your opponent control of the game if you take the cursed, distract, deliver a message, any of those in that quadrant, because they can then deny you stuff by taking actions.
Mm-hmm.
So, kind of looking at the breakdown of the game and looking at this chart, I think, okay, I don't remember, Mario, what we were playing, but like if it's squarely, if most of the schemes reside in one field or the other, then I start to kind of lean that way. And unless I think that I can synergize really well with something else, I will pick one of these corners and kind of stick with it if I can. Because me, like the Chronicles article talks about, I agree that kind of... putting all your eggs in one basket tends to help you out a little bit more.
Yeah.
especially in like a tournament setting when you don't know the guy across the table.
Yep.
If you're your local gaming store and you know what they're going to do or you know what they favor, then you can plan for it. And, you know, that's your own business. But
like in a tournament, if there's bodyguard on there, usually people don't take it if they're already in the tournament circuits.
Right.
And by putting everything in one basket, all the eggs in one basket, like, for example, if you have Frame for Murder and deliver the message, don't put it in one model and try to deliver the message and hoping that model's going to get killed.
Yeah, and, you know, it's... So, I mean, schemes are the glory of Malifaux. They're the great randomizer. They're the reason we don't just, you know, push all our models together in the middle and, you know, just kill each other.
And roll dice and hope everything hits.
Yeah, right. But, yeah, it does...
Now, any reason why you didn't put out strategies for this? Just schemes?
Well, I really only put schemes out there because strategies are shared. I mean, really... The strategy you should plan for, but I've played games where the strategy is both assumed to be something you're both going to score full points for. Like, most of the time, Reconnoiter is one of those where you're like, okay, well, unless I'm really going to put some energy into denying my opponent, most times I end up with Reconnoiter, everyone gets 3 or 4 points.
Okay.
So, you know, Turf War, okay, everyone's ready to just jump in the middle and beat each other to death. You know, they define the game, but where you really shine, I think, is in the scheme side of things.
All right.
I think that's where you have your biggest impact on the game. So let's say you're playing Turf War. Okay, so you're going to meet along the center line because that's where those 4 points are, but... are you going to double dip and try to do line in the sand at the same time? Are you going to, you know, because then you have to build a list that can weather that storm. You know, I mean, it does factor in, but to me the schemes are the thing that people have the hardest time with, not necessarily the strategy. I see more of my local players struggle to select the proper schemes for their crew than just coping with it to do the strategy.
Right.
You agree, disagree?
No, I completely agree. I mean, I kind of already thought why you didn't leave strategy, put it strategy in it. Scheme is a little bit more customized to your crew instead of, you know, strategy is already given.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the next step, you start thinking about these schemes, you start thinking about, okay, what did I bring to the table? Are you playing a vassal game where you're not model limited, where, you know... Okay, I have everything. I have even Brewmaster, you know, to choose from. Or do you only are you at a local tournament or a bigger tournament where you have to actually have the models in hand? So just, you know, as you're looking at your schemes, know that you might be forced into that killy corner, or you might be forced into, you know, one of those boxes and plan accordingly. When you're looking at that scheme chart, I also start plugging models into those corners. If I want to take control of my schemey objectives, then I might look at my faction and think Mole Men, think Tengu, think, you know, Terror Tots, mm-hmm. think those silly dogs of yours. You know. So I'm obviously going to take that direction and just start thinking then, how can I branch that out and synergize with those models?
If you want to be a little bit, get into more, you know, the competitive, not competitive side, but a little bit more into Malifaux, you could probably put those models into some kind of chart on Excel where you say, okay, Killy, Schemy, whatever. So you can actually just pick and choose.
Oh, and it's not black and white, too. Like, it is a spectrum, and as you move left and right on the spectrum between Schemy and Killy and, you know, whatnot, you can then, that's the optimization point. And we'll get to that in list building. But kind of, you know, those models that they're really fast, but they might be a little bit fragile, then you can have them kind of multitask to accomplish those schemes. But much like the Chronicle said too, you can plan for kind of what your opponent is going to do if you want to. Like I said, I don't really go with that so much as long as I'm bringing a well-rounded crew because, I mean, I'll go ahead and show my stripes here. I come from a 40K background, and don't plan on the "I gotcha." Like the just assume from the get go your opponent knows your list and what your list will do and how to hamstring it if they need to, and don't base your whole strategy on a secret weapon, because it might work in your local meta, it might work, you know, sometimes at tournaments, but at least in the bigger tournaments, you're probably going to run into a lot of people that do know what you're running. So really just looking at your own side of the table, and I think that's probably the most helpful part for a newer player or for someone who's struggling to accomplish their schemes.
And so, I think since we already started talking about what stuff to bring, I think we can go into the list building part, right?
Right. And that's immediately next. Oops, wrong page. Okay. So when we're looking at list building, get out your crew creator. Because, dear God, I can't tell you how much time I spend on the crew creator on Weird's website. Or
there's an app for it, yeah.
The app for your phone is amazing. Or just use it. Make sure you get your Soulstone totals right, and you know you're well on your way. And it's so much better than pen and paper, and it'll clear your head really well.
And you can copy paste it if you want to show it to someone. That if you want to, hey, what do you think about this list? Or you know, you post it on Facebook.
You want to play head games with your opponent? You know, stuff like that. the first thing with list building, really, let's be honest with ourselves. How well do you know your faction? Are you limited by the models you have? Or are you playing Vassal? Is everything on the table? Familiarity is really important. I'm not saying don't try new things, but in those critical moments when things are heating up, it's, oh, I forgot to do that. You know, those moments when it's just because maybe you didn't know this guy had that ability, that you want to make sure you bring your full force to bear and it'll help you as much as it can. Yeah. It is good to branch out, you know, and once you have a core that you like, add a couple models, or if you're just playing friendly games, go full bore and try a new master and go crazy. But be honest with yourself of what models you have available and how familiar you are with them. As far as the scheme pool, let's get back to making those synergistic choices here. Remember that you don't have to have models on the table at the end of the game to win.
Yes.
I think especially if people come from other systems where being completely wiped out is like anathema and, oh my god, I just lost full points and I'm done. No, you know. In fact, that's one of the achievements from last year's Adepticon. Win a game with no models on the table.
Don't lose hope when your masters died.
Right, exactly. Because, like, you should see your opponent's face when you're, you know, going just suicidal into something and then suddenly your schemes either, well, if you reveal them or not, you know, they make sense. And it's like, oh, wow, well, crap, 3 victory points for you.
Yeah, frame for murder on your master? Hell yeah!
Yeah, why not? So, and that's the thing, especially if you come from another game system, no matter how much you want that enemy beat stick master, you know, guy who punched your puppy dead, stick to the plan. So, when you're looking at the schemes that you've got, think of it, this is, again, all of these topics we're going to talk on kind of bleed together. So think about your activations. If you pick a lot of the schemey stuff, in general, you're going to need a few more activations because AP is a resource. Uh-huh. You're going to need enough models to get out there in order to drop schemes. Or, and this is the big or for Malifaux, is if you don't like the rules, cheat. Yeah. There's a model that breaks almost every rule in some way, shape, or form. You can't take an interact action. You know, incorporate a model that allows you just to place one. Like, let's see, Lucius does some of that.
Lucius, yeah. The Guild Austringer does that.
Yeah, the Shadow Effigy. Like, there's ways around it. So you don't like it, bring a model that sidesteps it, and you can save some soul stones that way. Because maybe I don't need to take a Guild Hound. Maybe I can just take an Austringer and, you know, anything really, and you just place a scheme.
Or you can have a model that pushes that particular target that you want, and then have that target drop a scheme afterwards, or a companion, and then drop it afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. So you can build those synergies, and that's what you're looking for based on the schemes that you're thinking about taking. Do you have enough AP to accomplish your schemes? But then, even more importantly, in my opinion, is if you take a low model count, can the models you've taken survive being out-activated? Mm-hmm. So, for anyone who's not familiar with the term out-activated, when your opponent maybe takes three more models, even if they're cheapy models, or if it's Leviticus Tamlin and they're just rats, you know, if you get so far behind in activations that your opponent can move with impunity for the last half of the turn and you have no response, can the models you took weather that storm and accomplish your schemes? Now, if you're taking Frame for Murderer and, you know, things like that, where it works out great because then your opponent's probably going to come attack you a lot. Could be part of your schemes and could be part of your plan. But something to keep in mind. Can you survive being out-activated again?
Yeah, this is why Gremlins is actually a pretty good, you know, example of this, because not only that they're cheap models, they also have Reckless most of the time, so you are probably going to get out-activated.
Yeah, and it goes back to that first point of you have more than enough AP to accomplish your schemes. So you send them like a missile to go accomplish your scheme, and, you know, who cares if they die? Look, they placed their scheme marker. Good job, buddy. You know, I also like to think during list building about my probabilities, and I don't like to get too far ahead on the have-to-haves. So maybe you really like, you know, running those models that have really powerful abilities, but they require a suit. So that means you either have to have that suit in hand, or now you need to start thinking about your soul stone cost and, okay, I need to leave a couple stones in order to make sure that power goes off. Uh-huh. So that's a good way to just kind of look at that, is how many henchmen are you taking? Because really, besides your master, it's just your henchmen that can have that soulstone capability. So if you play with a couple henchmen, just keep an eye on how many suits you have to have, because otherwise you might be spending soulstones that won't help you out, especially when you're spending them on upgrades.
Yeah, so, like if you have like one major trick that needs to go off and you rely on that card to be have on your hand, or you don't have any soul stones, that, you know, you're relying too hard on, you know, the stars to align.
It's a cool trick, but if it doesn't get to actually happen, it was wasted soul stones, especially on upgrades. Like
We practiced this whole entire conversation because it leads us to the next topic, right?
It does. But before we go on to resource management, I want to talk about synergies.
Okay.
And I think that some people see support models and they're like, this is going to be amazing. I'm going to take Toshiro. I'm going to take, you know, let's see, I've got Nico. I'm going to see how many models I can stuff in that have auras and pulses and buffs and, you know, stuff that's really going to just make that one punk zombie I have run forward and just destroy the world. But, you know, what happens when that one punk zombie dies and, you know, maybe you've been out activated? Well, now the rest of your turn's going to fall apart a little bit, perhaps. So just plan ahead a little bit. Remember that the more pulses and the more auras you rely on, the tighter you have to mess up, which means you're opening yourself up to blast. You've got other vulnerabilities. So just take it easy. Really think through how much support something needs. Uh-huh. You know, do you really need a triple positive flip? Really?
Do you really want to fish for that red joker?
Yeah, right. Are you really going for it? Because you might, you know, get it someplace better. So that's with synergies and support and whatnot, don't overthink it. Don't make someone a powerhouse, because as soon as your powerhouse dies, you know, you're kind of out of luck for the rest of the game.
Now, I think the other spectrum of that part is actually bring a list that nobody thought that you would want to go synergize with. Like, for example, my game with Chrissy was a 10 Thunders McCabe. She's used to me being playing McCabe as Guild, so she wouldn't expect. She knows that Sadir's going to be there. And I brought Sadir. Well, you told me to bring Sadir, Mr. Graves, and Izamu. So that's one henchman and two enforcers in that I don't... Well, the other two enforcers is completely out of fashion. One is Neverborn, one is a Resurrectionist, but they're both 10 Thunder, so I could bring them. And it completely threw her off. She knew what each model does individually, but when they're combined, she's like, I don't know that.
What happens? How do they play together? I don't know. You know? So yeah, like that kind of surprise, and that's why I love 10 Thunders personally, is because you just don't know what's going to come out of the bag. So, you know, when it comes to those support models, you can import tricks from other factions if you're playing right, or even with summoning, you know, think about what you can summon, and, you know, that's the harder part about summoning is having such a breadth of knowledge to know what you can bring out of your bag of tricks.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah. Now we can, let's just recap that, because that was kind of a lot of stuff to look over with list building.
Yeah.
Recap being, list building, how well do you know your faction, and you should probably stick to your strengths, maybe salt and pepper with new stuff if you like. Look at your scheme pools, and focus on the objectives. Make sure every model you choose has a purpose, and whether it's just to add activations, add synergy, add some melee strength or some range strength. It's all should be in support of your scheme pool. It doesn't matter if stuff dies. Just go for your schemes. Don't overcommit on high-cost must-haves that require soul stones or high cards, because an ability not used is wasted soul stones.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, synergies. Support your models, but don't overcommit on auras, pulses, buffs, that might better be used on either just moving that model and completing a scheme instead of just making one model amazing. So, moving on into resource management. Now,
this is the fun part.
What's that?
This is the fun part.
Yes, resource management. Remember, we're talking about pre-game resource management. It deals a lot with that list building aspect. And when it comes down to soul stones, I say forget them. You don't need them. Don't use them. No, I'm just joking. But
that's kind of radical.
Don't automatically build in your default 7 soul stones into your starting cache. Again, for those last reasons of how many soul stones do you need for an ability to go off? You know, do you have a super squishy henchman or master? Do you need them to survive? Okay, you know. Give yourself a couple more stones. Do you pretty much have a resilient crew and all the squishy stuff stays in back, maybe? You can probably go a little bit lower and either add another model for an extra activation, add that upgrade that might add some useful tools to your bag. But yeah, that's the big thing. Don't just go for 7 stones because it allows you to adjust on the fly. Most often I see people who start with a 7 cache, unless they've planned for it and they have a distinct purpose, they'll have, you know, 1, 2, or 3 stones left at that breaking point of the game, and it's already kind of been decided. So they kind of end up a little wasted.
And I know a couple of people in my... I don't have a local meta, so it's the global meta that I've met. They're more comfortable with 6 stones, 7 stones, but... The way that I see it after I played in the Vassal League is if you didn't think that you had soul stones to begin with, you make better decisions at the end.
And there was a great thread on A Weird Place a while back. I don't remember who participated in it, but it was like, when do you feel like you've kind of gotten a level up in your Malifaux playability? And one person said, when I stopped taking 7 soul stones at the start. And I had to think about that. I was like, you know, as someone whose first crew was Jacob Lynch, and my buddy's first crew was the Victorias, we're both starting at 1 soul stone. So, you know, when we were like, all right, well, we don't have a lot of those, so let's just go for the gusto. You see that you don't need them, but when you have a couple extra, it really illuminates the power of them for you when used correctly. So, yeah, exactly. Getting out of that comfort zone, I encourage you to try it. It's not as bad as you think.
My comfort zone has been lowered and lowered after the Vassal games that I had on the league.
Yeah. Yeah, I could imagine. But on top of soul stones, when you don't have soul stones to burn, look at cards. Now, we're talking cards as far as planning ahead, like in list building and whatnot, not cards during the game. But immediately when starting up your game and looking at your list, think of how many abilities do my guys have that require me to discard a card? How many of them require crows or tomes or masks, depending on what faction you play? You don't want people competing for the same cards, especially on like upgrade abilities and stuff, because remember, a upgrade not used is soul stones wasted. So you got to kind of plan on that and look across the entire spectrum of your crew and how they should go together.
Like a Perdita crew would probably prefer rams because of critical strikes. Or if you have Sadir and Lady J at the same time, they're going to be fighting for that mask for either the Vendetta trigger or the Onslaught trigger or the Riposte trigger.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that's the major thing is like you're like, oh, man, if only I had, you know, take stock of how many times you say that during a game and try to just earmark that for later of, okay, maybe I should take, you know, two more resilient leader minions rather than, you know, the one big guy who's going to compete with my master for the suit of choice. Uh-huh. And if you are low on activations, you know, be aware, if you took a lot of abilities that require discards, sometimes when you're out of activations, you might need to keep those high cards in your hand to save your, you know, whatever models are still left. So if you're planning on a low model count crew, it's kind of best not to need to blow, you know, all your big cards and face cards on abilities that, you know, you might be salivating to get going. removing that temptation, because I know I've done it a whole lot where it's just like, you know, I get so excited about, you know, my beat stick running in and doing some massive damage and maybe killing off a master or a key scheme runner or something like that, and I use a card, and then my very next activation, I'm like, I knew I
needed this card for something.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, that's the time you just kind of go, okay, I need to, you know, put that card over here. If you actually can physically put it over there, it might not be a bad thing, even if your opponent knows what you're going to do. Remember, playing like your opponent knows your crew is not necessarily a bad thing. It just, you know, keeps you kind of focused and centered. So that's all I have to say about cards, really, is just don't over-specify, don't over-commit on one type of resource, one type of suit, one, you know, high card.
I agree on that part, and I think it's worth to note that also not relying on having certain things back going to, you know, soul stones and stuff, not relying onto certain things in your hand kind of makes you feel like, you know, you can create better decision, especially in choosing your crew as well. Like, I think 10 Thunders is good in this situation as well, because they have so many, you know, different models you can take from different factions, and usually they require different triggers or different suits to trigger certain things.
Right.
So it spreads out your hand a little bit better.
Yeah, and it gives you that freedom of choice, which now you've created, if we're going to keep referencing 10 Thunders, you've created a scenario where you have freedom of choice for suits, for cards, for like a large crew, a small crew, you know, you really have a lot of versatility as far as what you want to bring. And as long as you don't overcommit on supporting one model, you know, you won't even be huddled up. So you can have models expanding around the board and you don't feel like they're out on their own and exposed. And that's kind of empowering. You're not really worrying very much as you play the game, which is nice.
Okay.
Let's see. Last resource being AP. Again, we kind of already touched on this. The more scheme-heavy your scheme choices are, the more AP you'll probably need to achieve them. Because go ahead and count on some of your dudes getting tied up with the enemy, you know. Your opponent is going to try to keep you engaged. If you don't like that rule, cheat. Do you have a model that can't, like a doppelganger, that can just interact even while engaged? Oh, if someone's not expecting that or they forget about it, like, you know, seeing their face when you're planting line in the sand or planting explosives or anything like that, and they're just like, oh, man, you know. it's perfect. It's perfect. So, you know, there's models around that. And by taking a doppelganger, maybe you don't need to take two Terratots. So that's a cost of 8 for the Terratots, 2 Terratots, versus I think it's, I want to say 7 for a doppelganger. Maybe it's 8.
7 or 8. It's high.
It's in there. But yeah, so I know there are some synergies where you can save that kind of Soulstone cost and give yourself some help. So watch it where your AP is going to spend. You can take tricks in order to achieve those schemes and save some AP, but also look into guys, if you feel pretty confident that your 2 Terratots are going to be able to tear it up, and maybe they're running Power Ritual and they're going to, you know, opposing corners of the board, maybe spend some of your Soul Stones on soaking up enemy AP. What can you do to slow your enemy? How can you suck up his resources? Do you have things like Depleted or really anything that gets like plus flips, plus melee on disengaging strikes? Uh-huh. Those are awesome. What dishes out slow or paralyze? Make that happen, because even if you don't kill that model, taking away your opponent's AP might deny them their schemey abilities. On the flip side, if people take killy lists and schemes and stuff where you have to murder people, then you're not as AP intensive so long as you take, you know, really beady stuff. So you can save some AP, like if you go off-suited there with one of your schemes is very scheme-heavy, one of them is, say, assassinate. You know, you save yourself some requirements for that AP, and then you don't have to worry so much about getting bogged down, because some of your models actually want to be in combat then. So something to think about with your AP is don't just think, well, I don't have anything to do with this AP, so whatever, pass. You know, it's a resource, so try to make each one count. So those are really all I have to say about our resources and how we spend them. The deployment and the placement of models, that I think, after all this list building, after all this discussion, I really think where you put the models on the tabletop at the very beginning of the game is the most important step.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Because, yeah, it's just, if you bunch up and your opponent has blasts, you're done. If you bunch up and you don't even have enough room to move your own models in a way that is going to effectively use those AP to accomplish your schemes, you've basically hamstrung yourself in playing bumper cars with your own models.
Or if you overspread your crew too much where you actually need them to bunch up, then...
Right. So, with this deployment, and you're making your choice on where to go, like, let's go back to that New Venice idea.
Yeah. We can even use my example as well.
Yeah, sure. I wish I had that screenshot. I could have pulled that up. Okay, so we're looking at New Venice here, and Mario and I chose to deploy in the standard, you know, top and bottom configuration. Come on, you. Okay, there we go. And Mario ended up deploying down here in this corner with some guys on the bridge, and, like, they were all kind of bunched up, and, you know, it wasn't bad, but it allowed me to hard castle over here as well. And the thing was, I brought a shootier crew. Because when I was looking at this map, I thought, man, I either need flying, incorporeal, or I need to just not care about it and shoot people. Because the more I have to interact with the climbing, with the severe terrain, with, you know, those things that drain my AP because they're reducing my, you know, my movement speed, that's going to make it really hard for me to get to the center line, which, let's face it, most of the action happens on the center lines as far as achieving victory points. Mm-hmm. Basically, by hard castling on the right for me up here in the green, I had space to move. I had some options. Hard castling for Mario down here on the right, he was kind of cramped up because of the bridge, because these barrels, building. Yeah, he was playing bumper cars. So, I mean, right there from the get-go, it was a tough space to be in. So, I mean, I know that like after the fact we talked about it, and there was definitely like those, man, I should have deployed that differently, and it would have been.
Actually, before the game, I had the idea of deploying differently. I got overexcited, and then my brain resets back to 2 days before what we're originally planned to do.
Yeah. So, you know, that deployment in the beginning, make sure you give yourself enough space. Make sure, I mean, really for turn one, except for, you know, in a few cases, you can plan most of your own moves without too much enemy interaction. You can, if you're looking for, you know, hardcover, dense stuff that, anything that blocks line of sight, you can plan, okay, that guy's gonna go over there. And yeah, there's lures and there's guys who are ultra fast or who can shoot at you. But if you plan to be in some kind of defensive position, it's not exactly, you know, too hard to guess where you're gonna go in that first round of the game. So that's my main point there is, just kind of plan out your first turn and see where it's going to go. And especially if you're used to using the models that you've brought, you know how they synergize and about what distances they should play well with one another in order to get them supporting each other.
And if you have From the Shadow, be careful, you know, where placing him, because in some circumstances that From the Shadow, basically you're offering them to just kill it right away.
Yes, From the Shadows, I mean, unlike other games, this game, you know, if you deploy first, your From the Shadow deploys first. Uh-huh. So I know we all want to be deploy From the Shadows second so we can have that clutch position, but if you have deployment From the Shadows and you go first, you need to make sure you plan ahead because they can just come after you when they see where you put it. Uh-huh. So that's an important point. Remember that scheme pool. Now that you're deploying second, you can kind of counter them, but don't get bloodthirsty. You know, you just need to accomplish your schemes. That's the only point. You can deny them their schemes. That's great. But if they hard castle and like you take outflank, who cares? You know, you've got to have that model on the far left side. So, you know, make sure you set something up over there. Yeah, so just make sure you align your deployment with your schemes. Don't bunch up for bumper cars and blast markers. And that's really the... keep ideas on where the best choke points are when you're choosing your side. I didn't really touch on that, and I should have. Sorry. Out of order. As far as choosing which side to deploy on, look for which one has the most cover. Again, look for those one-way... one-directional elements, if there's any on the board. Most of the times there won't be. But if there are, they can really swing the game. Look for best choke points in relation to the center line. Because if you set up the table and then you flip deployment, as most of the times you do, as it's on our little, you know, step-through card, you might have a natural choke point that really favors one side. Mm-hmm. Cool. Use that to your advantage. And just keep that in mind when you choose to go first or second. I know most of the times people decide to go second because they think to themselves, then I get to see where they're going. Now I get to react to them. Well, if your opponent, you know, chooses the more superior side for his crew and leaves you out in the open, like in New Venice here, and you're stuck with no cover, you know, mm-hmm. McCabe gets rapid fired. That's all I have to say.
Now it goes back to anti-douchebaggery.
So, yes, that brings us into point six, which was just basically sportsmanship. Mm-hmm. I really just want to give a big disclaimer here. These are my opinions for 95% of the games that we play, and just because somebody adheres to the rules as printed in black and white in the book does not make them that guy. Mm-hmm. All right? You know, some people are cool with, you know, taking stuff back or whatever.
I think adding into that whole disclaimer is you can be a rules lawyer, but you don't have to be a douchebag,
right?
As the rules lawyer.
And you can be a good guy, have a good game or gal, and have a good game that completely adheres to the rules, and it's not a problem at all. I love those games just as much as I love the casual games that, you know, I might be too inebriated to remember. So, I've just got a couple points here that I'm going to bring up, and then I'll leave it because I think this is a slippery slope topic that we don't want to really get ourselves
more.
Yeah. So, my first point is don't get in a rush. And confirm the steps of the turn before proceeding. And what I mean like by this is, I know a lot of times, especially in tournaments, as things speed up, as time gets low, people just start flipping cards. Okay, I'm going to shoot you. Okay, I'm going to lure you. Okay, I'm going to defend. Okay, I'm going to, you know, this, that, and the other thing. Well, what about if the opponent wanted to use a soul stone for defense? You know, that's something that has to happen before any cards are flipped. You know, what if you got ahead of yourself and you didn't say it out loud? Oh, when did you declare that trigger? You know, did you flip it? Oh, I meant to say that, you know, you'd be slowed, you know, that kind of thing. Maybe you get excited to shoot that guy who's out in the open and you just start flipping cards. And then your opponent has to ask you, well, did you pass your terror check? You know, did you pass your manipulative check? You know, and then you're in kind of that gray zone. So in order to avoid that, don't get in a rush. You know, kind of announce, you know, keep the dialogue open with your opponent as you're playing. And, you know, that just kind of makes for a better game anyway. Now, if you're being stringent about things, which is totally cool, you know, decide with your opponent what the best way to go forward is whenever that happens. Most of the times, if cards haven't been cheated or whatnot, you know, you can kind of sort out what was supposed to happen. But in most cases, I just say reflips happen. You know, I mean, especially in Vassal, you can just hit the undo button, find out what card was going to flip when, and look, okay, there's my terror check, here I'm going to cheat this, you know, everything's kosher. And that's my best advice there.
If you're in a tournament, and you got into, like, not an argument, but you can't make a decision, just call for a TO.
Yeah, and, I mean, that... For me, a TO is always kind of the last resort just because it'll be faster from a tournament perspective for you and your opponent just to come to a gentlemanly agreement on, okay, let's do this. Because a TO might drain 5 minutes to get their attention, get them over, explain the scenario, you know, all of that, where if you and your opponent could have just kept it cool and been like, you know, okay, let's do this, or let's just, you know, flip for it and, you know, we'll go with that. You know, I've done that before. Whatever you can do to sort it out yourself, that's great. But yeah, if not, then just grab a TO and move on because time is precious in a tournament environment. And I think probably if you aren't dead set on one play style or another, being like, you know, if you're flexible, between your, you know, local game store or tournaments or whatever on, oh yeah, you forgot that trigger, that's cool. Oh yeah, or not. Could you, you know, we're not going to count it this time. I say that, you know, mirror the courteous play you receive as appropriate. You know, is your opponent interjecting wiggle room in his timing declarations? Like, you know, oh, I forgot to declare that trigger. You know, you might just remind them and like, if you don't want to allow it, that's fine. Just let them know and be like, oh, just make sure that you declare it, you know, and you might even throw out there, hey, do you have any triggers to declare before you move on to damage? You know, and that keeps you from being that guy, but you're still adhering, you know, to the rules. And your opponent will appreciate that because they're also, you know, learning the rules and making sure that they're following them too. And that's ultimately a good feeling. Or if, you know, if your opponent is extending that courtesy to you when you forget a thing or two, it might be nice to, you know, return that back. Or and not to nitpick them, you know, and that'll just keep the game friendly, moving along, no argument, no time wasted, and everyone just has a good time, and, you know,
but
that's all.
If your opponent lets you have that 1 millimeter difference next time that he does it to you, then obviously you should give it to him.
Right, right. Well, you know, it gives for a better play experience, and really, you know, that's why we push little plastic people around on a board.
Yeah. Or, I mean, in that particular example as well, that 1 millimeter difference, let's say if you're not giving it to him, you can probably say the reason why you don't want it. Like, I usually do give you, you know, that kind of distance, but this one, if you actually kill my model, I can't do certain things anymore. Explains to them why you're doing.
Right. Or, like, especially when things get too far ahead. When it's like, you know, three or four card flips, one or two cheated cards. Oh, I meant to call that trigger, did I not?
Yeah.
As soon as you get like a couple steps away, it's okay, in my opinion, to just be like, well, bygones be bygones. We're not going to go back for it. Sorry.
Yeah.
And most reasonable people are totally cool with that. So, those are really, you know, all the points that I have for talking points. If we, you know, really, again, you know, looking at the field, determine your, how the terrain is set up and how you best can use it to your example or to your advantage. Your schemes, you know, are you going to focus on killing? Are you going to focus on accomplishing schemes through scheme markers? And are you going to take control, or are you going to give control to your opponent in some cases? Using that knowledge, your resource management, and then your eventual deployment goes all those go into the list building and how you're going to synergize them. And then, you know, just to have yourself a good game and make sure that, you know, it's just fair on both sides of the table.
I actually said that I was going to disagree on some certain things, but after we actually talked about this, because we didn't rehearse this whole thing at all. So, and I ended up, you know, agreeing to most of his points. And then he actually agrees to most of my points as well. So, I mean, it wasn't supposed to be a debate. It was supposed to be like a talk where, you know, it's just based off personal experience as well. I tend to get along with a lot of people playing Malifaux, because I'm not a douchebag. So, you know, it helps. Give and take with your opponent. I think that's my last advice. Give and take with your opponent. Of course, discuss it with your opponent first. If it's a tournament, situation, put yourself in your opponent's shoe. If you're in his shoe, would you actually give him that extra millimeter? That kind of thing, you know? Like, oh, yeah, if I do this, he's not going to be able to do this. You know, be fair, because this game already has cheating involved in it. You don't want to cheat further than the regulated cheating rules. But, yeah, that brings up, you know, towards this is at the end of the talk. If you guys have any comment, you know, just remember that these are all just our opinion. Disclaimer, these are all our experience. Like, just based off our experience, you know, big air quotes and whatever. Disclaimer, this is our opinion. If you have a different opinion, though, if you want to talk about it civilly in public, please comment down below. Like the video if you like it. You know, we're going to have a little bit more of this because Alex actually just bought a camera so he can be involved in a little bit more of the videos. I love that. He's all set for it, and the only thing he needs to figure out is waiting for his kid to get bigger so she can sleep by herself.
Yes, timing with children, that's important.
But thank you, Alex, for coming in. Thank you for spending 45 minutes. This is perfect timing, and people can listen to this while they're painting or doing whatever they're doing.
I hope people enjoy it, and I look forward to any questions or comments people have. So.
All right. Thank you guys for watching. I'll see you guys next time.
Thanks.